You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Perspectives on an Intellectual Career, second Q&A panel with Adam Mossoff, Larry Saltzman, Robert Mayhew, and Alex Epstein. This lecture was recorded as part of Ayn Rand Conference Global's How to Put a Dent in the Universe, a conference examining an intellectual's role in society and how it can shape the world.
So if we can bring back all of our panelists from this session, we're going to turn to Q&A. We've got just about 10 minutes or so for that. And, you know, we get lots of questions, more than we can really handle in the amount of time that we have. But some of our speakers are going to be participating in the social hour. They'll have their own breakout room. And it's one of these Zoom features where they're self-selected breakout rooms. So you can say, I really want to talk to Professor Mossoff, and go to his room and just go right in there and have a little more opportunity to engage. So if we don't get to your questions here, there will be opportunities later. I'm just going to jump right in. You know, again, it's a wide-ranging session, and we got questions on a lot of different topics. Larry, to concretize what you were saying about how litigation can be strategic, can you give an example of one of the cases, maybe one of your favorite cases from PLF, that you could, you know, just sort of concretize what that looks like in practice?
Yeah, I could give. You can hear me, okay, Keith?
Yes.
Yeah, I can give an example of a case, and then how it becomes a campaign. So I met somebody in Michigan by the name of Yuri Raffelli. And he had an interesting story. He owned a home in a suburb of Detroit. He couldn't pay his taxes for about 2 years, property taxes. And the law in that state is eventually, if you don't pay your property taxes, they can foreclose on your home to collect the taxes. And that seems reasonable. That's basically, at some point they have to be able to collect the taxes. But he caught up on his taxes and paid them late and miscalculated the fee and ended up underpaying by $8.41. And the law in Michigan said, not only do they foreclose on your house, but they don't foreclose on it for the purpose of collecting the taxes. You completely forfeit your house. So he lost his $60,000 home for failing to pay $8.41 in fees. And he found a local lawyer. They lost at trial. And we took the case over on appeal. We lost on appeal, if you can believe it or not. That's just what the law was in Michigan. And ultimately, we went all the way to the Supreme Court to the Michigan State Supreme Court. And we saw this as an opportunity to turn this one case into a property rights cause, to make the point that strong property rights are a matter of justice and about economic security. And we did that because we learned through some research that not only was this happening in Michigan to Yuri, who won at the Michigan Supreme Court, got his house back after 5 years of litigation, but we learned that it's happening in 12 other states. And so we developed a whole strategy around that. It's an opportunity for us to take on this issue where people are suffering this real injustice. They have these predatory tax regimes that are forfeiting people's entire homes for small tax debts. And we can show that constitutional provisions like the excessive fines clause, like the due process clause, like the takings clause are meant to protect people in their property rights and should be strongly enforced by courts. And so we engaged in not only that case in Michigan, but we filed additional cases in Michigan, which generated publicity. We went and wrote op-eds and did Public Records Act requests to find out the extent of the problem in these other 12 states. And we've subsequently, over the last 2 years, generated cases in 5 additional states. And just this year, we petitioned one of those cases to the United States Supreme Court. So the idea is, over a 5 or 7 or 10 year period, we take this issue. It's a good way to elevate property rights to a national conversation. We solve an important social problem through the litigation of these cases. And we leave the message that property rights are important, they should matter to you, and we should be strongly enforcing them through the judiciary. And so maybe that's an example.
Good, thank you. Okay, switching gears entirely. Robert, you said that there was something that Ayn Rand said about Aristotle that you initially disagreed with and then later learned that, you know, that she could. So the question is, what was it that you disagreed with, and why did you come to?
Right, she says in effect, and she said something similar in the Randall, her review of Randall's Aristotle, that it was the rediscovery of the works of Aristotle that made the Renaissance possible. And the standard line I had heard was that, you know, Aristotle is the philosopher of the Middle Ages, Plato is the philosopher of the Renaissance. And you could see people coming to that conclusion if they weren't looking in terms of essentials. There was a sense in which by the time the Renaissance rolls around, Aristotle is the symbol of all these crusty old scholastics who can't think outside the box. And you know, there and Aristotle and Plato's works are being discovered, and they're really there's a lot of study of them. And so you have a lot of these Christian Renaissance Italians, you know, considering themselves Platonists. But so at first I thought, well, she's a genius and I love her, but you know, we can't all be historians of the Renaissance, whatever. But I did a lot of research, and it was just, it was so clear that if you look at Aristotle's influence on the late Middle Ages, I mean, the explosion that happened in the 13th century, leading to Thomas Aquinas, his views are condemned at first, but then they eventually become official in effect. And the effect that that had in, like at the University of Padua, where you have, you know, William Harvey studied the posterior analytics, Galileo did. And so even Galileo was aware that, you know, I'm against the peripatetics, but I'm really more of a peripatetic than they are. He says in the dialogues, the two world systems. So there was a sense that, yes, she was right. It was Aristotle that made this possible, but it wasn't clear. And so I didn't feel bad that I disagreed with her at the time, but I was happy that it turned out that she was right and that I sorted things out eventually.
Okay, switching gears again, this is a question primarily for Alex. So there's a question about if you're going to specialize, and especially if you're going to be entrepreneurial in your specialization, there's a question about expertise. So there was a question that came in Spanish. Do you have to be an absolute expert on a topic, even to start talking about it in front of an audience? And what kind of, and a related question from somebody else, what kind of challenges did you encounter working in a technical area, not necessarily having gotten your training in with that area, you know, in that area from the beginning?
Yeah, great question. So I think to just take this commercial focus again, I think the primary thing is, when do you actually have value to offer to the world? And I think that's like, there's these things that can be indicators of value, like, oh, I have a PhD in energy or whatever the relevant PhD would be. But they're only indicators, and they're not the best indicators. And I think increasingly, it's not what matters the most. So I would just say, when do you think that you actually know something that other people don't know that will be valuable to them? I mean, that's when I would say start talking. And then, you know, it depends on what your interests are, but let's say, you know, you are interested in a few things and you find that, well, in one of them, what I say really resonates, and then people are interested in more, then you keep doing that. So for me, it was, I mean, Keith, you were around for this because you knew me when I started ARI in 2004, like I had no specific interest in energy at all. And it sort of came up, but really was in 2007, 2008, when I just started talking about it, and it just, like, certain things started to resonate. I got more interested in it. I taught a course at Ocon in 2008 about the history of the oil industry. I really loved that. I really loved learning about that material. And even then, I knew some stuff other people didn't know. Of course, I wasn't like a world historian, but I had a perspective that I could explain the events in a way that was valuable because I knew a ton about objectivism that I could apply. And then people were interested in that. And even on the explanation point, just one other thing is, I noticed that I got told by people from the oil industry, hey, the way you explain the value of oil, I've never thought about. Like, I figured out, oh, take a walk through your life and just look at everything that's made of oil. And if it's not glass, if it's not metal, if it's not rock, it's probably that black stuff, you know, you see when there's an oil spill. Like, isn't that fascinating? And here's how that works. So, and then the more of that you can do, you know, the more valuable it'll be. And then you'll get the expertise you need. I mean, my kind of expertise is interesting because it's so project focused. It's like, I'll have a project, it'll be successful. Then I'll figure out another project that I need to do. And I have most of the knowledge I need to do the project, or at least a decent amount of it. But then a lot of it I learn. So I never, with one exception at the beginning, I listened to this, I read this guy, Peter Beckman, who was, I thought was really great on energy. I read the back issues of his thing called Access to Energy. And that's one other thing I'd recommend, is just, if you think there's somebody who has a lot of detailed knowledge and the right general philosophical approach, like, take, just inject that stuff into your veins, because that will give you a huge leg up. Just like I would tell someone now, if you want to go to energy, like read Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. Like I wouldn't beat around the bush, because that's going to give you a context that's going to give you like an understanding that other things aren't going to do. But I wouldn't worry, just as long as you're creating value and as long as people can perceive it, eventually you'll keep getting better. Eventually everyone would. I mean, I'm always getting called like Dr. Epstein and all these things. And like, I studied philosophy at Duke as an undergrad. Like, I have no formal training at all, but nobody cares. Particularly once you're, as Cal Newport put it, like once you're so good, they can't ignore you. Like if you can beat everyone in a debate, what are they going to say? Look at my diploma. Nobody cares.
Okay. Adam, a question for you that's similar to the question for Larry. If you look at the kinds of cases where they've taken up some of your writings or some of your articles or arguments that you've put forward, can you give us an example of a, sort of a favorite one that that has had an impact on cases?
Oh, sure, and happy to do so. And it's related to some of the points that Alex was just making as well, because it's not just about writing your ideas and putting, you know, and publishing your articles, but learning how to frame them and package them and make them accessible to people who aren't necessarily academics themselves, because that's not my audience, my sole audience as a law professor. I want judges and lawyers to be reading my work. And so you do need to think about how to frame this. It's why a frame that I often use when I'm talking to people is, you know, using the fruits of, you know, that intellectual property secures the fruits of productive labors of innovators and creators. It's a, you know, phrase that I started using to show people that there's nothing odd or weird or unusual about intellectual property. It's usually framed in that way by a lot of people, especially critics, but even advocates for it sometimes say, oh yeah, it's a little unusual, I have to explain it. And I said, no, this is the same thing that we're doing when we secure a farmer's property rights in their crops and the products of their labors over a course of a year, and that they can sell in the marketplace. And so, you know, my favorite was when Justice Gorsuch picked up, was heavily Justice Gorsuch on the United States Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, a recent appointee, in a case, picked up some of my phrases and was using them actually in his opinion. So he actually, his very first paragraph of his dissent, unfortunately it was a dissent, but you know, this is like what Larry says, you first lose cases and then you start to win them. You create the ideas. But in his very first paragraph of his opinion, he talked about how a patent secures the fruits of the labors of the inventor. And no one has said that. In all of legal academia and the IP world, I'm the person who kind of coined this phrase about how what inventors are doing and what the patent system does. And so it was really exciting to see a Supreme Court justice internalize this phrase that I had done. So he didn't quote me. He actually just used the phrase, which was wonderful from my perspective. And like I said, it's in dissent. And because you know, very oftentimes, sometimes you're trying to show, you know, a current system or current action by the government is wrong. And, you know, you're going, and so initially there will be dissents. The progressives that Larry mentioned initially were in dissent in the early cases and that they were fighting for, and eventually it shifts. And so eventually, hopefully the dissent will become a majority opinion down the road.
And just a follow-up there, for Adam and Larry, do you find that there's complementary work by objectivist philosophers that you find yourself drawing on in either your legal practice or in your legal academic work? So how much sort of, how much do you draw on technical philosophy or the works of objectivist philosophers? Larry, why don't we start? You're both,
Larry? A couple of sources. I mean, certainly Tara Smith wrote a very interesting book about judicial adjudication in the context of objective law. The title is escaping me, but it's a very interesting way to apply law objectively that is not originalism, which is sort of the main theme in law over the last, say, 20 years. And so I do recur to that fairly frequently, and that's kind of technical philosophy. But I think more fundamentally, to help me understand what's going on over the last 100 years, say in law, it revolves around the, I think a lot of the breakdown in law came from a kind of philosophical crisis around the fact-value dichotomy or the is-ought gap and understanding objectivism's theory of value has helped me just place it in historical context to see, like, oh, what's going on in law is part of a much greater tradition, and I need to learn to speak in terms that cause judges to have clarity and confidence about their role in a constitutional republic so that they will be more confident ruling for us. So it's not direct, you know, I'm not lifting things out of that. So there's that kind of technical stuff. But on the other side, lots of things that contemporary objectivists are writing about individualism is very helpful for me just in framing our issues, because I'm dealing with, you know, where the rubber meets the road for individualism, certain constitutional rights, the protection of individual rights in courts. And I need to have language on my side about how to think and talk about individualism in a consistent way. And that I don't know any better source than objectivist writers lately.
Adam, did you want to add to that?
What Larry said was excellent, and I 100% agree about the unique value that objectivist writers have to offer, especially people like Tara Smith. I highly recommend her work as well in the area of philosophy of law, that she, and in particular legal areas and doctrines that she's been writing on. Related to what Larry said, for instance, you know, Ayn Rand's insight about the nature of value and how this is kind of a key fundamental concept in the foundation of her entire ethical theory was just like foundational to my understanding ultimately of the moral justification for intellectual property, that, you know, values have to be identified and created by humans to achieve our purposes in life and ultimately a flourishing life. And and, you know, there's no one else who says that. But of course, as Larry mentioned, and as other people have mentioned, there are, you know, lots of people who are doing interesting work on specific legal areas in the law that are of value. You know, in the constitutional law space, in the intellectual property space, and it really depends on what someone's interest is and in what area of law that they're interested in. So I can't speak more generally, but maybe in the breakout room, I could give some suggestions of topics of areas that people are interested in.
Okay, great. Well, we're slightly over time here, so I just want to thank our panelists one more time. So thank you all for joining us, and I hope you can stick around for the breakout rooms, which are going to be starting in about 15 minutes. So we have a slide. So the breakout rooms are going to be in a Zoom meeting. Right now we're in a Zoom webinar because you can't do a webinar in a meeting space, and you can't do breakout rooms in a webinar space. So we're going to switch. So we're going to put up a slide that'll show you how to get to the breakout rooms in 15 minutes. So I'll just say, thank our panelists and say goodbye to you guys. And so what you're going to do is we have another link, if people could post that into the chat. When you leave this meeting, you're going to leave the webinar and you're going to go to a different Zoom URL. And starting at the hour, we'll have the breakout rooms. And again, how these are going to work is the speakers are each going to have their own room, and you can choose to go there. Let's see, I'm getting some messages from the crew and the production crew in the background here. Well, why don't we take another question while we're, Adam, somebody wanted to know what the Ayn Rand quote is that you have on your wall in your office. Do you remember that offhand or?
Oh yes. It's the, it was the purpose of, my philosophy in essence is reason is man's only means of knowledge, and his life is his only center of value, and his happiness is his only purpose. It's a beautiful summation quote of what her philosophy represents, and the ARI once made a very pretty printed version of this that I was able to frame and hang on my wall.
Great. Okay. Okay, well, I think we'll put up the breakout slide during the break. So we're going to take our break now, and we'll put up the information over the break for how you can get to the breakout rooms, and we'll look forward to seeing everybody at 2:00 Pacific time and whatever that translates to in whatever part of the world you're coming from. So thanks, everybody, and we'll see you in just under 15 minutes.
See you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.